My guest in the studio, well, he started playing piano at the age of 16, but later switched to the saxophone and fast became one of Australia's finest jazz multi-instrumentalists, playing alto, playing tenor saxophones, clarinet and flute. He's recorded a number of critically acclaimed albums and has been based in New York City for the past 2 years, performing with artists such as Bob Mintzer and George Coleman Jr. Adrian Cunningham, welcome to Now's the Time.
G'day, Frank. Thanks for having me.
You enjoy a very loyal following here in Sydney, especially in Sydney. You've made frequent return visits back to Australia to keep that connection going.
That's right.
And, of course, your Sydney quartet is now solidified. It's been going for around about 8 years, I think, something like that, as a unit.
That's right.
But you've also recorded with a variety of artists from mainstream jazz to funk. Tell us about the DVD that you're currently releasing.
The backstory is I grew up with a lot of New Orleans music, particularly Louis Armstrong. That's my father's influence in jazz. That's where it came from, my initial desire to get into the music. And so it's always been a part of me, and I've always enjoyed the music, and I have fond memories when I was young and starting out of going to listen to Tom Baker down at the Wynyard Hotel. And the Benny Goodman Centenary was coming up last year, and I'd been doing a number of shows at the Woodfire, you know, the place at Double Bay that is no longer, unfortunately, but was a wonderful room, and we had this this concept going for a while. And with the centenary happening last year, of Benny Goodman being born 100 years ago, we thought it would be a great opportunity to present a concert like that. And I'm sure some of your listeners are aware of the Cremorne Orpheum,
which is
a great venue, and Paul Drevet does a tireless job in promoting music there, especially jazz. And it all came together, and we ended up filming it and releasing a DVD. So
excellent.
It's a great swinging band. It's some of the best guys with that style of music. We've got John Morrison on drums, Peter Locke on piano, Dave Putney on double bass, and Glenn Henrick on the vibes.
Possibly in releasing a tribute to Benny Goodman like this, some people might say you're putting him on a pedestal, so to speak, and you may not be staying true to your own artistic merit. What's your view on that argument?
Well, it's interesting because this, as I said, this concept had been running for a number of years, and every time we'd play, people would come up and say, you know, why don't you record? And my answer was, well, why should I? You have to buy a Benny Goodman album. You're going to hear what I'm trying to do with the real thing, you know. So it's one of those funny things. It came up last year, and I'd really got into the music in New York. I happened to have been playing a lot with a trumpet player called Ed Pulser, who used to play in Benny's band. And all these things came into play, and I thought perhaps doing a DVD, and I actually talk a lot about Benny Goodman on the DVD as well. I talk about his life and tell a lot of stories. So it's not just about the music. It's about the whole thing, and the Orpheum is a wonderful room. I wouldn't have done a CD about it. I think, you know, I don't see the point personally. But a DVD is something a little different.
So it's almost like a musical documentary in a period setting.
That's right.
Which suits the period of Benny Goodman's height.
And, you know, we try and keep true to the style. You know, I don't try and, you know, kind of reinvent the wheel. But, you know, those tunes are so beautiful, and, you know, the boys play great, and I thought it would be a great way to present something like that.
The last time we spoke, back in April 2005, so that's about five years ago.
Wow.
A lot of water down the Hudson River since then.
That's right, man.
Adrian, at the time you listed some of your major influences as Benny Goodman, Woody Herman, Joshua Redman, Cannonball Adderley, and, of course, Sonny Rollins. Now that you've spent 2 years in the hotbed of New York City, how has the natural diversity of the musical culture there affected your music and you yourself?
Well, I think the thing that strikes me the most about living in New York, especially compared to living in Australia or Sydney, which is where I have the most experience, is they have a really rich tradition and a real respect for the tradition of the music and the history of the music. So, you know, seeing tributes like, you know, we talked about, you know, why do a Benny Goodman tribute, that's really common. You'll see a lot of the great artists doing things like that. And it's not so much about, perhaps, you know, one angle might be, well, they might be cashing in on a name, which may be true as well, but I think the more important thing is it's about having full respect for the history of where the music came from, rather than just try and say, okay, I'm going to kind of start this thing anew. So for me, I think it was a real wonderful thing seeing this music in the full spectrum of it. You know, you have incredibly musicians playing incredible traditional music, and then the same musician playing something extremely avant-garde. So for my ears, all of a sudden, everything started to come into perspective more. I could see that the full history of the music relates. The early stuff is just as relevant as the later stuff, as the more avant-garde stuff.
I was going to ask you about New York City and whether you would consider it still a place where you can concentrate on specialising in music, so
very
to speak,
much, yeah.
Because, you know, there's enough work in the area of your choice. You know, you don't really have to explore other types of music. Is that still true?
Oh, yes. It's extraordinary. I mean, the thing is, there's so many different scenes. You know, it can be overwhelming when you first go there because you can, you know, Smalls by itself is its own little world. You know, you've got, for those this is not familiar with some of the venues, Smalls is, you probably want to call it the most straight ahead venue in terms of guys playing. You know, it's kind of post bop, and it's not so kind of avant garde. I mean, this is aside from all the big clubs like Blue Note and Vanguard, which have all the big names anyway. The scenes where musicians hang out. So you go to Smalls and you've got guys that know the full arrangements of the original bebop recordings. They're not just playing through the heads, you know, and tipping their hat to it. These guys know everything backwards. Mm. Same thing goes for the traditional scene. You've got traditional musicians. The repertoire is enormous. That's one thing that hit me as well. Like, you've got to learn tunes fast when you move there. Same thing in Harlem. You've got guys that know that Blue Note period from the 60s, the organ trios. There's a whole world of that as well. So it can be pretty daunting,
yeah.
Because, you know, here you are coming from Sydney. I think a lot of musicians would agree with me when they say that you have to diversify in Sydney to be a professional musician.
That's
because,
right.
You know, the scene isn't big enough. You can go to New York and you spend your whole life on one era of jazz, 1, 5, 10 year era of jazz, and that can be your thing. So for me, I guess it's still an adjustment. I still love, as I said, the full spectrum, and I'm hopefully going to find my way somewhere in there. I really don't know, but, you know, I'm enjoying every bit of it. I don't really know.
You know, having such an array, I mean, I know I was there for about 4 days some years ago, and I saw Mos Allison, Ron Carter, and the Mingus Big Band in as many nights.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that sort of thing goes on night after night after night.
Oh,
if you're not working for a particular reason, you out checking this sort of stuff out?
Absolutely. I mean, I've been really busy the last 6 months. You know, things I've, as you said, I think I've been there 2 years now, and, you know, it builds momentum. The more you're there, the more contacts you make. So up until coming back here, it's been 6 nights a week for me. So, I mean, I do try and get out as much as I can, and I'll take any opportunity to play. So I'm at a lot of the jam sessions, you know, because that's my schooling, that's my learning experience, you know, is going to those things. But I'll try and check out whoever I can, you know. The flip side of it is, being a musician in New York City, you're not earning the salary of a Wall Street banker. And some of those expensive clubs, you know, like Iridium, for example, you can spend $60, you know, just seeing one set. And it's hard to get a lower price than that at that place. So all that stuff adds up, you know.
Yes.
So I try and get out and see a good band maybe once a week, you know. But I also try and make myself have a night in as well. That's the flip side of it. You can go out every night. It's addictive.
What's the lineup of the group?
That's the working quartet that's been around for, well, they're not working so much these days. They're going to be overseas. But it's Bill Risby on piano, Dave Putney on double bass, and Gordon Rittmeister on the drum.
Kurt Elling recently, he was quoted during a monologue in his latest album saying, "We're jazz people," he says. "We're jazz people." Now, jazz people have always been somewhat romantic, I think, about New York City being the jazz corner of the universe. What have you found? Is it myth or reality? Do you need to be in New York City these days, do you think?
Well, I think that's something that everybody has to answer for themselves. It's a very personal thing, and I know. I mean, the reason I moved pretty much cold. I basically organised a visa and bought a plane ticket without any promise of work or anything like that. But the reason I did that was because I'd been over there for several short trips, and the last trip, which kind of led me to that decision, was I heard some great music, and I came home. I kind of looked at my life here, and I thought, you know, I'm never going to play like that in Australia. This is for myself.
Ooh.
It's not speaking for anybody else. And, you know, for me, it would be like speaking French and not moving to France to further yourself. You know, I think that jazz just seems to make much more sense to me over there in terms of its context. I think the history of the people that are there and the African-American culture, it really is ingrained. You know, and of course, New York City, not only that, New York City for anything is cutting edge, any sort of art or expression or anything like that. So, you know, I really love coming back. You know, the reason I come back is because I have such a good time and I get to work with such wonderful musicians, and I really love that. And having the opportunity to come back maybe once or twice a year is great. But to be in New York City, to be part of that tradition, to experience that, I think, for me, that's really invaluable. I didn't want to kind of look back at my life, you know, if I never had left and would have wondered how I would have been, you know. So that's why I did it. And
do you recall the moment in time when you were inspired to move from the piano to the saxophone?
Oh, gee. It was a pretty gradual transition, and I still play a lot of piano. And when I first moved to New York, I bought a little digital piano, and it kind of drove me nuts. I ended up getting a real piano, and it made a big difference. So it's always been a big part of my music, and I do a lot of composing on it. You know, I think a lot of musicians do.
Mm.
But, you know, it was really... I started playing saxophone in high school. I started on piano when I was 11, saxophone when I was 16. But it was the clarinet that really kind of got into the jazz thing, because all of a sudden I brought this old clarinet home from school and I put on one of my dad's Louis Armstrong records and I heard Edmund Hall playing clarinet with Louis, and then I just started playing along, and it was so exciting for me. All of a sudden this instrument had its context.
Mm.
With the saxophone, I was kind of doing it in the school band and having lessons, and it never really made sense in terms of what I was doing with it. But the clarinet seemed to fit with this music, you know. So I guess, you know, late teens is when it started to make sense, you know, and then, of course, the saxophone followed as well, you know.
There are a number of legendary images in the minds of jazz people, where, you know, when they think of saxophonists practicing, you know. Mm. I think of Dexter Gordon on the banks of the Seine in Paris, and Sonny Rollins on the Williamsburg Bridge.
That's
in
right.
New York City, and then, of course, Bernie McGann here in Sydney down in the Royal National Park.
Out in the bush.
How much time do you have to practice, and do you have a special place that you like to practice?
Wow, well, it's not quite that romantic for me. I'm afraid it's stuck in my bedroom with the door shut so I don't piss the neighbours off. But the great thing about New York is that you can literally play 24 hours a day. And as I think I mentioned before, I make every opportunity I can to play. So I'm often playing in Central Park, you know, with a modern trio. Like, there's a drummer who runs a group. And great things have come out of even that configuration. That same lineup, we did a tour of the West Coast in February. And they're by no means amateur musicians. These guys are serious, you know. Mm. But it's the context of playing outdoors like that, you know, and performing and just kind of sharpening your axe, you know, and we work on difficult tunes and expanded repertoire and odd time signatures. So that's a really good way to do it, you know. And as you know, you have so many like-minded musicians who've moved there that are just as passionate as you are. So it's a great opportunity just to make music wherever you can. So, you know, we do a lot of playing outside.
Unamplified?
Unamplified. So it's an acoustic bass. And these acoustic bass players, they've got a sound. You know, these guys know how to push it because you're playing outdoors. And for me, the first time I did it too, it was a real kind of shock, because you're playing in an acoustic space that is so big.
The sound just goes.
You can't fill it like you can a room. So it's a great mindset. It's like training with, you know, with ankle weights or something, you know. It's great for your sound and developing.
Well, I remember my father always telling me about Louis Armstrong, when he saw Louis Armstrong, and being quite close, and how the sheer volume of his playing was something formidable. New York audiences, Adrian, are they tougher than Sydney audiences, do you think?
I think, well, it's really hard to compare. I mean, that's a tough question. The rooms are so varied. I'd have to give you specific examples. So my favorite audience to play to is in Harlem. You've got Harlem has an incredible, obviously, a black community, and there's this room that I often go and sit in and play at. It's called the Legion Post, which is kind of the equivalent of an RSL. But it's nothing like an RSL, culturally speaking. It's like being in an old black person's lounge room. It's fantastic. So it's a real sense of community, and they respond like I've never seen before. If they like something, they're going to holler at you.
Yep.
It's fantastic. And to be in the room with that much energy is extraordinary. It's wonderful. Then you have, you know, the bigger clubs. You've got the Blue Notes, the Iridiums. These people paid a lot of money. They're here to listen, and it's generally good, you know, and very receptive. You know, people don't talk. Smalls is great as well. People are generally receptive. Sometimes you might get a few drunk people at the back talking, but overall it's great. What else is there? And a lot of the smaller restaurants, things like that. Yeah, I think overall people often, you know, when they're in New York are traveling through, so it's not like generally a local scene as well. People come to New York, and the jazz is part of the thing that you want to do when you hit New York. So people want to go out and hear the music. They're not just kind of, it's not just in the background. So
yes.
I think generally people are perhaps more receptive, but, you know, SEMA has a certainly a great room, and people are very receptive there too. That's much more of a concert setting, you know. Perhaps the concert rooms are a little less in New York. It's not so much about being a concert, but being part of a club and drinking and, you know.
Yes.
Yeah.
What's the strangest thing that's happened to you since you were living in New York City?
Oh. I'll tell you a funny thing that popped into my mind when you said that. When you travel home, you don't drive in New York City, basically. Everyone catches public transport. And when you're a musician, you go home at all hours. So, you know, I'm often traveling home late at night. And it's generally safe. You know, New York has the stereotype of being a dangerous city, and that was cleaned up a long time ago. I've never, ever felt threatened at all. But one night I was traveling home about 4 a.m. into Brooklyn, which is where I live, and I was just minding my business. I think I was reading a book, you know, and there was probably 6 people in the carriage. And I hear this voice screaming at the other end of the carriage, "What are you looking at?" And I look up, and there's this really drunk, possibly homeless guy staring at a reflection of himself in the glass of the carriage, just staring at himself. And that, and he said that, and then he just laid down and went to sleep on the seat. It was so funny. And there was a girl across the carriage, and we looked at each other, and we just burst into laughter. It was fantastic. Things like that happen all the time. Hilarious.
What a classic. What a classic. When you visit Australia intermittently, have you found any changes to the local jazz scene here? We're being informed that since the relaxation of the licensing laws here, especially in Sydney, there's been an increase in the number of available venues for musicians to work in. What have you found?
Well, it's fantastic to see 505 starting, you know, officially starting.
Yes.
That's wonderful because, you know, when people often ask what's music like in Sydney, my answer, unfortunately, has been, you know, well, it's not great because, I mean, if you look at it, we're in a city of how many people? 6 million?
4.5 million.
4.5, okay, yeah. 4.5 million. And we haven't had one full-time jazz club in how many years? What was the last official one? Soup Plus?
When Soup Plus, yeah.
So my answer was, well, unfortunately, we've got no official jazz clubs, you know. That's great news. I can go back now and say, well, we do. You know, I hope that that's going to survive and do well, you know, because I think we need rooms like that.
Do you have a specific goal that you're looking to achieve in New York City? You mentioned off-air before your next outing is possibly a local recording in New York.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely on the cards. I mean, the reason I move there is the reason why I do what I do, and I'm pushing myself, and it really is, the bottom line is to be the best musician that I can be, you know, and relocating was part of that. And that's all that really matters at this point, you know. I feel that my growth in the last 2 years has been really good. It's been a really positive step, you know, and I really feel a sense of kind of maturity and everything coming along, you know, almost from week to week. So I'm just going to see where that takes me, you know. That's really my only goal, and that's kind of always been it for me too. You know, things like doing recordings and things like that, they're almost kind of like benchmarks and along the way. That's the main goal. Hopefully when I'm 60, I'll look back and say, man, I gave it the best shot I could, you know. That's kind of it. It's probably a little cliche, but
that's all you can really ask, isn't
right.
it?
Right.
Adrian Cunningham, thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you, Frank. My pleasure, mate.